You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Guidepost. You've got Will Poston here from ASGA, joined with Ben Martens of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. We are going to be talking about several topics today, but many of you guys, our listeners, have likely seen some of the damage on social media, through your local news outlets, or you know, many of you guys are up in New England and likely experienced this spate of storms the past couple months, and just the incredible destruction that much of New England experienced. And I think it's safe to say I use the word incredible in the worst way possible. So Ben and I are going to dive into that, because I know Ben has been tirelessly working on efforts to rebuild and get fishermen back on their feet. So Ben, how are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me to chat, and everybody for caring about what's happening in the northern reaches of New England when it comes to the working waterfront. We've been very busy in response to the two storms that hit our coast in the middle of January. There's been a lot of destruction. There's been a lot of communication needs, a lot of fear that gets associated with everything that's kind of changing around us. And so we've been working a lot. Sometimes it feels like we're running on a treadmill on full speed and working really hard and not getting too far. But it's a community effort. So I really appreciate you guys reaching out to Tat.
Yeah. So, you know, I was during one of those storms, I texted a friend up in Maine, just seeing how he was doing, if his boat got pulled out in time. He was like, fortunately, I'm all right. But I mean, he sent videos, Ben, of just, 60-foot lobster boats just banging up against the rocks on the shore. Like, I mean, can you kind of add some color to just the level of destruction, some of these storms? And I know, it was kind of like one of those worst case scenarios, right? Where you had a powerful storm. You had a full moon tide, there's a lot of energy up in the Gulf of Maine now with some of those water temps, right? Like there's that angle too. So can you kind of, explain what happened to folks that maybe aren't as familiar?
Sure. I'd be happy to kind of walk us through what happened. And so essentially what happened is we had two storms back to back that hit our coast. And the first one was in the middle of the week. We knew that this storm was coming, but it shifted a couple of different pieces along the way. So one was, instead of coming from the northeast direction with the wind, which is what we are used to with our nor'easters up here in New England, this one was kind of coming from the southeast. And when that wind starts pushing in that direction, a lot of the docks and wharfs and piers that were built to protect against nor'easters are now exposed to weather, wind, waves in a way that they were not built to withstand. So we had a unique storm pattern that was coming in, and it was coinciding with king tides. Right. So we already had very high tides that are flooding over a lot of this infrastructure that we have in Maine already. And then we had also an extreme flooding event taking place at the same time with snow melt and rain. So we had, kind of a trifecta of pieces coming at the coast at the same time, with water coming from the inland, rain coming down. We had saturated ground, right? So my basement was flooding, and I'm, in a coastal community, but my basement shouldn't be flooding in January, right? But everything was saturated. There's no place for the water to go. And then it started to get windy and it started blowing. And so that was the 10th of January. We had a massive storm kind of run into our coast, and that ripped up and destroyed a lot of working waterfront, really severely impacted it. And then we had another storm that hit on Saturday. And that storm was even more extreme in terms of the flooding, just because of the timing of when it was hitting. And we had already suffered so much damage. So we had docks and wharves that were wiped clean off the face of the earth. We had extreme flooding take place. We had, you know, concrete wharves that had been standing for, you know, decades that were ripped apart. You could see the concrete blocks moved by the tide pulling in and out. So, you know, those were some pieces of it. The other piece of it was just, you know, as we start to have, you know, these types of storms hitting with a lot more uncertainty, you know, some of the projections around how high the tide was going to be were off pretty significantly. So the Port Clyde Co-op, they moved all of their gear for the first storm up above where they thought the high tide water was going to be, where it was projected to be. And then that high tide mark severely, surpassed where they thought it was going to be. So they had forklifts, they had freezer units, they had all kinds of equipment that they had moved up beyond where they thought the storm surge was going to go that were also destroyed. So, you know, we had this projection problem of what the impacts might look like, what the flooding might look like. And then we had the actual, you know, storm that was really, really severe and coming in directions that we weren't used to. So that's the scope of what kind of where we got to, where we started. So that started on the middle of the week and then Saturday. And then, you know, by the end of the first storm, we started hearing reports up and down the coast that, like, this was really bad. This was something we were not used to. Many of us even.
Yeah, that's the sentiment that I heard from Pat Kelleher, you know, chief over in Maine DMR, just talking about, you know, he, I think the words he used, and I'm sorry, Pat, I'm not directly quoting you, was, I never thought in my lifetime I would see water that high on the coast of Maine. Like, he was almost in disbelief. And this, again, this was 2 weeks ago after, you know, all the dust is settling. So just, you know, that level of storm just was not even on people's radar.
No, and to have two of them back to back is just incredible. So we were rushing in between the first and the second storm to try and clean up, right? Everybody knew it was coming. So people were like, how do we shore up the properties that survived? And how do we start getting stuff out of the waterways now in this short window that we have? And so it was a mad rush up down the coast to kind of in between those storms.
I think it's also important for, you know, some of our listeners to understand, you know, many of our membership, right? Like, they pull their boats out, you know, the center console guides, some of these big boats that, you know, you're, representing for Ben, you know, are, you know, not as readily pulled and are still, you know, there's a lot of fishing activity that goes on in the winter, through your membership, right?
Yeah. The winter is one of the most profitable times to go fishing for lobster and groundfish. Scallops, we're right in the middle of our state water scallop season, which is one of the most profitable fisheries that you can participate in New England. So there's a lot of boats on the water, both groundfish, scallop, and lobster. And, you know, there are definitely those boats that get pulled in the wintertime that are the fishermen that are mostly summer fishermen, whether they're part-time fishermen or they're older fishermen or they're younger fishermen, right? Like, there's those that have built different types of businesses. But for many of the businesses that are the highliners in the lobster fishery, they're going year round now. And the winter is when you often make your money. So that's one of the pieces of this equation too, is there's a lot of boats out there. There's a lot of infrastructure out there. There's bait in a lot of these places that got flooded too. So we were up in Port Clyde with Representative Pingree, and Jerry Cushman, who runs the co-op up there, was talking about how they had thousands and thousands of pounds of bait in the bait shed that, you know, the doors got ripped off. One entire side of the building got ripped off, and with it, all the bait just went flowing into the harbor. And so I'm sure that was a nice stinky way to get exposed to the storm as well.
Yeah, there might have been some giants still up there in the Gulf of Maine, licking their chops from that outflow. So, anyways, Ben, you know, clearly there's a ton going on. I was getting emails, 3-4 emails a day, it seemed like, from, you know, New England representatives, associations like yours, to kind of, you know, first it's you got to document everything that's going on and try to help people. And then it's, okay, how do we physically rebuild? How do we get back on our feet as quickly as possible? Because, you know, for commercial fishing, it's not just the fishermen, it's the whole infrastructure. And, you know, the sentiment I'm getting from up in Maine is several prongs of that infrastructure and that operation are were severely affected. So, you know, how are you guys working? How is the state of Maine, other New England states, to get everyone back up and running as quickly as possible?
Yeah, so I think that you're right in kind of outlining for organizations like ours and even the Department of Marine Resources, the state, counties, municipalities, right? First stage was communication. And I think everybody will admit we were not ready for the storm, right? The Department of Marine Resources in Maine has never had to administer a disaster like this. They haven't had to run point on a disaster like this. So, you know, when we were telling fishermen how to report their damage and where to go, we were getting conflicting information. And, you know, people were telling, you know, Pat Kelleher, oh, you know, have the towns report. And Pat's asking the fishermen to do that. And then the municipality is like, we don't have the capacity to handle that. And so there was a lot of confusion. And, you know, as I kind of said earlier, like a lot of fear comes along with that, right? You know, you're seeing your properties getting destroyed. You're seeing, in some cases, your houses get impacted. You're seeing your businesses get impacted. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about how are we supposed to react? What are we supposed to do? How do we help? And so our organization really leaned into, we want to be sharing as much information as possible with our fishermen and our coastal communities. And that was what we leaned into hard early on, working with the Department of Marine Resources and other industry groups to share and get that out. And then for the many fishermen and other working waterfront businesses in Maine, we have now been shifting into how do we actually distill out what happens in on the other side of a disaster, right? So we have FEMA response, we have Small Business Administration response, we've got state, we've got federal. There's all these pieces that come into a disaster. And Maine is a fairly unique place in that we have lots of working waterfront. Most of it is privately owned, right? And it might be attached to a business, it might be attached to a home, it might just exist, right? We have a lot of working waterfront that if you were to ask who owns it, there's a collective shrug. And that is really hard to either identify who's the one supposed to have insurance. A lot of these wharves are not insurable anyways, right? Or who is responsible for rebuilding? Or who even owns the property, right? Like there's a lot of those questions that are now popping up that are going to become troublesome on the other side of the rebuilding effort. But that's, you know, those pieces are where we are spending a lot of time now, is trying to make sure that people understand, you know, FEMA is going to come in. FEMA money can go to primary residents that were impacted and municipalities, so not businesses. Small Business Administration is going to come in and they might be able to get some loans to small businesses that were impacted. Many of our fishing businesses don't fit well into that bin. And so now we're sitting here trying to figure out what other types of resources can we help connect fishermen to in a time when, I would say talking to people at the marine resources, fishermen, municipalities, we have probably either lost or had severely impacted close to 60% of our infrastructure throughout the state. And
just to reiterate that 60% of Maine's, you know, fishing infrastructure, fishing community, right? Maine has a lot of fishermen, all different sizes, you know, not motivations, but, you know, different fisheries. So that I didn't even realize it was, you know, the level of impact was spread across that, you know, that far through that throughout the community. So again, just incredible damage in the worst sense. So Ben, you were kind of, you know, adding on, you know, how you guys have been helping communicate through, you know, DMR and your fishermen. Are there any, you know, concrete steps that, or goals that you're hoping, you know, to achieve over the next couple months to really, you know, have you know, project ready dollars coming to rebuild?
Yeah, I mean, right now we are, so the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association has set up a donation fund on our website where folks are able to go and donate to. Obviously, like, that fund is not going to be able to rebuild. So what we are going to be focusing in on with the first level of that is getting that out and helping facilitate the cleanup process. Many of these docks and wharves that were destroyed, they need to get pulled before you can even start to rebuild, right? And that will take heavy machinery. That will take, you know, it's pressure treated wood and lumber. Where is that going to go? How are you going to move it around? There's a lot of costs associated with that. And some of those costs might be covered by federal funding, but right now they're not. And so we're going to try and help facilitate. We've been meeting with, you know, Casella is a big garbage trash recycling company in New England. We're working with them to try and figure out how we can kind of coordinate a response in the cleanup efforts. So that's our first stage right now is helping there. And then we're working with our delegation and our state to try and figure out if there's additional resources that we can start to pull into the space. And we're also starting to talk to foundations and, you know, on the grant side of conversations to say, a lot of the money that's going to eventually come that might be helpful in rebuilding won't be here for a year or a year and a half, depending upon what our congressional delegation, what our state is able to do. And we need to go fishing this year, right? So how do we put a Band-Aid on this? How do we build a bridge between now and the hopeful future where we have resources that will allow us to build back taller, stronger, better, right? But right now we have to go fishing. There's some that need to go now. There's some that need to go in the summer. How do we get the infrastructure? And for those that are, you know, on the recreational side, both in fishing and in boating, a lot of times we have shared infrastructure and aquaculture, boating, recreational, like, all of that infrastructure is also going to have additional pressure put on it, either because it was impacted by the storms or because there's going to be more commercial fishermen who need access points like that. And so those types of conflict are going to start brewing. There's going to be new interactions. So there's going to be a lot of pieces of this that start to continue to fall out in our communities over the next year as we see consolidation of effort into certain types of waterfront that either survived or was able to get funding quickly. So unfortunately, like, I don't have clear answers in terms of where we're going. The shortest thing that I can say is, like, I'm telling all fishermen, so you got to start doing your shit, get out there, go clean, go build, follow the rules and regulations and keep your receipts. Right. And we're going to try and help figure it out. But if you can't go fishing, you can't make a dollar. And that's going to be the death of the industry and a lot of our businesses that are, like, they need to be moving if they want to survive. And so that's where we've been kind of helping facilitate.
Yeah. So Ben, you also mentioned, you know, exploring, like, new funding sources. And I know, you know, this has been not a buzzword, but a huge priority for the Maine delegation, both on Capitol Hill and, you know, just Mainers in general, this idea of working waterfronts and kind of creating new funding streams to, you know, shore them up, you know, make them more resilient for the future, improvements, what have you. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about some of those initiatives that are kind of floating around on the Hill and, you know, in your head, how you're thinking about them?
Yeah, sure. So the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, we've been working at a federal level for several years in partnership with the Fishing Community Coalition to try and work with both Representative Pingree and Senator Collins to build some different working waterfront bills to support the need that really exists within this infrastructure, right? And so Maine, we have a great congressional delegation that is willing to lead on this, but working waterfront is a major issue throughout the United States. But we don't get a lot of attention because we have so few representatives and senators who either have the knowledge, the expertise, or like the willingness to stand up on working waterfront and fisheries issues. Fisheries are hard, right? Like, and that's, and most of our country doesn't have working waterfront, right? Like, it's a hard place to find network, to find coalition around working waterfront.
Yeah. And just to butt in a little bit, you know, one of the frustrations that we've come across, right, in some of these committees of jurisdiction, there aren't many representatives that come from ocean states or ocean districts. And, you know, they have a lot of authority, you know, by being on those committees and having that jurisdiction. It just adds another layer of challenge to getting, you know, initiatives like working waterfronts or, you know, improving fisheries management, what have you, across the line.
And working waterfront is really hard to define too, yeah. Right? So like you and I might be sitting here saying working waterfront is for getting access to fisheries, right? Like we need these docks, we need these wharves, we need seafood movement across it. We need recreational harvesters being able to go out there and catch stripers and tuna, right? Like that might be how we define it. There's a whole other subset of people who see working waterfront infrastructure as LNG terminals, as offshore wind, places for, you know, development. And so, you know, there's a wide range of things that fall into working waterfront. Some of those things have resources behind them, right? So if you look at how we define working waterfront in Maine, a yacht club is working waterfront, right? And there's been a growth of yacht clubs in Maine. That working waterfront is thriving right now. It is not in trouble. But the working waterfront that's attached to harvesting seafood is struggling to find its value point in terms of, you know, gentrification and how you pay for it and how you invest it. You know, all of those things are really hard right now. And so we've been focused at a federal level through our delegation in Maine. Senator Collins and Representative Pingree have really stepped up and been leading on this for years now to say, working waterfront, seafood-related working waterfront, recreational access working waterfront is different. We need to figure out how to put funding into this. And we've missed out a couple of times when trying to get it into infrastructure bills or trying to get it through Commerce, right? Like there's just, it's really hard to move money through Congress right now, hard to move anything through Congress right now. And, you know, we've been thankful that we've had such great advocates at the federal level on this issue, but we are trying to, you know, we are continuing to push and prod and build on those bills, and, you know, build coalition around those bills. But it gets hard when you start trying to figure out how to count those votes, and the real need that exists.
So let me ask you, Ben, you know, obviously, you know, we've talked about how this, these two storms in January kind of exceeded everyone's expectation. And, you know, for, gosh, I can't even put a number figure or, you know, how many years working waterfront has been discussed and, you know, how long you guys have had some of these bill texts. But was there anything that you all have potentially learned through this storm process that, you know, might be implemented or not implemented, but like rewording some of the working waterfront language to, I guess just lessons learned through this current storm process and, you know, how you can improve the idea of working waterfront, you know, that funding stream.
I think that some of the lessons that we've learned are things that we kind of understood, but we didn't want to pull to the front as much as we probably needed to, right? Working waterfront, it is crucial on a regional and state level, but it's managed at a municipal level. And so if you're manage anything at a municipal level, they need capacity, right? Like they're making decisions about ordinances, investments, you know, zoning, all of those things, right? So this is a town by town, municipality by municipality issue that you need to be addressing. And the best way to get them to help address that is providing the funding that they need to make those investments. But it's incredibly difficult to move funding from federal sources into private businesses. And, you know, that's the place that we have a problem in Maine is that, you know, we have some co-ops, we have some municipal docks and wharves, but so much of what we have that makes Maine so special, and makes this fishery so special, makes this place so special. Those, they don't fit well into a grant program. They don't fit well into a loan program. They don't fit well into any of these things, right? When you have to start putting like, well, if the federal government or the state government is going to make an investment in some infrastructure, how do we protect that investment, right? And that can be in both through resilience, so building it stronger, higher, whatever those things are to make it climate resilient, but also making sure that if a fisherman owns a wharf and they take money from the federal government to invest in it and build it stronger and better, and then they hit the end of their business life and they put it up for sale and there's no other fishermen that want it, and suddenly a large, you know, someone with a lot of money steps in and is like, I want this shorefront property. Well, so then is that wasted federal money that is now no longer being used for working waterfront? Those are really hard things, and you can use easements, but all of that stuff is kind of subject to money. And so we don't have good examples of it. There's a lot of interesting examples in farming for how you protect farmland, but working waterfront is not farmland, and we are not managed under the same administration. We are not managed in the same way. And so some of those things we try and like put on top of working waterfront doesn't fit at the end of the day. And so those aren't good answers for you, except to say, like, we're still learning. We're still advocating. We are still trying to figure it out. The two things are like, one, we need money. We need flexible money. And then we need product moving across those docks, right? Like that's, whether it's aquaculture, seafood, recreational, like we need people and product moving across docks in order to show their value and keep them working. And so that's the other piece of the equation, is we can't just say we're going to protect and preserve and put an amber, right? Like, we don't want these to change. It's like, we need to invest and preserve and innovate on. And that innovation piece is not always something that people within a community are like, oh, wait, you're going to put a hoist onto that now? Or you're going to, you know, start having a food truck down there where you land lobsters? Like, that's not what we want. It's like, well, but it might be what you need in order to fund that piece of property. And that's, change is hard. And change, like, we want to protect, but we also want to protect the opportunity to change as fisheries change, as communities change, as needs change. And that, you know, catch 22 of preserving and innovation is something that we all struggle with in this space.
But, you the way you were describing, just trying to manage all these different factors and, you know, like we're fisheries people at heart, right? Like it reminds me, like I joined ASGA back in 2021, and the year prior, listening to Tony, my boss, being like, I had to learn all about, the small business stuff with COVID. And, he was going through Congress, trying to iron out how to get, our guides and fishing businesses that, we're told they can't get on the water, how to more or less survive for that, stretch of time. And it's, like, again, we all try to work in the fisheries space, but every now and then you have to, evolve and adapt and do what's needed to protect these interests, we all represent. So again, all our listeners, feel free to jump on MaineCoastFishermen.org to learn more about this rebuilding effort, how to, if you are a Maine fisherman, what steps you should take, and, learn more about Working Waterfront's initiatives. But Ben, while I've got you, another pressing issue up in your neck of the woods in the Gulf of Maine that I know, I've pestered you over the last year about and trying to, get everyone on the same page, is BOEM's Gulf of Maine, offshore wind process that is nearing, we're nearing a final lease area. Lease sales are, the auctions rather, are scheduled for later this year. how have you guys been approaching offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine? Because, you know, I know this is such a challenging topic. You know, we've struggled with it just, you know, in the Southern New England area, so much of this stuff happened so quickly, where, you know, it, maybe there wasn't as much input. Maybe the right players weren't involved when you look at some of the, where some of the leases are. I mean, it's just, you're no matter where you go, you know, you're there's always going to be pulls to either side, and it's just such a it's just a brute force industry that it's difficult to positively engage on. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that both we and BOEM, so BOEM is the administration that, you know, kind of does and facilitates the leasing of offshore wind, right?
Apologies to everyone for my use of acronyms. It's a terrible habit that so many of us in the fisheries world struggle to shake.
Yeah, so they are, you know, energy, right? So they are extraction of resources in the ocean that are not fish. And so the management of fish is not part of BOEM, and the management of our oceans when it comes to energies and minerals is not part of NOAA. And so there is this inherent conflict between, you know, how do we manage our ocean resources for the greatest good for our nation? And when it comes to, do we use them for food production or do we use it for energy production? You know, we don't actually have a coherent plan in place. The Obama administration had tried to do marine planning, and they invested a lot of money and energy before your time, Will. But they put a lot of time and energy into marine spatial planning that was well intended, but didn't have any real like weight or hooks behind it. So it was some of that data that was used and collected and processed is now being used. But you know, that was one of our biggest issues with that was like, well, if we were to say that through this marine spatial planning process, these areas need to be off limits, does that actually do anything? And they're like, no, but we'll put it into a map, right? It's like, okay, so great. Like this isn't zoning of the oceans. This isn't, you know, so I just say that with the, it's been an important piece of context that I try and express to our fishermen and our community members that like there are two government agencies with conflicting missions in the same areas, and that makes communication and engagement hard. And for those that have been involved in fisheries, we have a lot of issues with fisheries management as fishermen and recreational harvesters, right? But the more you work in other places of the federal government, the more you realize how collaborative and open access and like grassroots fisheries management is. It is one of the most like democratic processes left in how we manage our natural resources in the entire United States.
I was actually on a call the other day, and you know, this guy was describing how unique fisheries management is, that, you know, in the context of overarching, you know, federal government regulation, you know, making, like fishermen and other stakeholders in marine resources are more or less crafting their regulations. You know, it may always not be the, you know, what everyone wanted, but they are entirely ingrained into that process, which is something we all lose sight of from time to time. You're right.
We do, right? Because it's like, oh, well, Noah's making us do this. Or Noah's, it's like, yeah, but you had a say. You had a chance to make your voice heard. You had a chance to participate. Like, there are certain requirements. There are things that we need to do. But, like, there's real access to the decision makers in a way that we have gotten so used to that we forget about. And then when you go participate in the BOEM process, or, you know, in trying to understand the BOEM process a little bit more, like the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association started to look at other places that resources are managed, right? And so you start looking at farming and ranching and, like, you know, national forest, and like, it's a lot of it's very black boxy that we don't have in fisheries, which is just really interesting. And so I just say that because like we had to go and learn an entire new way of working with the government to try and engage in the offshore wind. And there was a lot of struggles and there was a lot of frustration. And I think that also from the BOEM side, right, there was a lot of struggles and frustration from them. And I think that really came through in Southern New England and New York in a way. And I will give them a ton of credit in that they came to Maine, they came to New England, and they're like, we learned some lessons. We're going to really go out and we're going to have a lot of public engagement. We're going to go to the fishermen. We're going to create public meetings. We're going to create private meetings. We're going to go to these places and these people and ask for their input. And we are going to listen. And I am, you know, from a personal standpoint, and the Maine Coast Fishermen's Assembly, like we are opposed to offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine. We don't believe that that is the place for energy production. But I get to give a ton of credit to the staff of BOEM. Like they came, they met, they took their beatings, and they did, right? But they kept coming back and they kept listening. And the maps that they have put out right now are very reflective of what the fishing community asked for. I'm very appreciative of that. Like I'm not happy with like the idea of saying we're going to go and put structure out on the Gulf of Maine and try and create energy out there. Cause I ultimately don't believe that that's the solution to climate change or what we need to be doing in our oceans right now. But for a process that is very different from what we are used to, I'm very appreciative that they really took the time in Maine, especially to meet with our fishermen and listen. And I think that's reflected in the maps. And so where we are right now is, you know, we've got these draft areas. They're going to put out some final ones and then we're going to start getting some bids. And I think that there's going to be some fishing communities and fisheries. Some of the ones that I work directly with in the groundfish fishery, herring fishery, those offshore fisheries, where that's kind of where they're pushing this right now. And there's going to be some hard conversations about what can exist out there, what can't exist. There's big questions about the technology that'll be used and how we get the energy in. And so anyways, there's still a long way to go. And I think that, you know, your membership needs to be paying attention. Ours is definitely paying attention, but BOEM has shown that they are willing to listen and work. And now the question is like, how do we make sure that the companies that are going to come in and start putting these bids out there are also going to be willing to listen and work. And I don't know that that's been the experience that people have seen in other parts of the United States right now.
No, Ben, I'd agree with much of that for sure. And that's kind of been the approach we've taken, right? But in the Gulf of Maine, when we got involved, and, you know, and again, like this is the best time to get involved before concrete leases are finalized. But you know, in general with wind, like our biggest concern has always been, you know, is this industry progressing according to the best available science? Do we know what the ecological impacts are going to be? You know, how are ocean currents going to change? Like, we don't really know these questions. You know, there's so much uncertainty with wind. And then when the Gulf of Maine process started a year or two ago, you know, this is in water that's deeper than 150 feet. So you have to use different technology. And that technology is floating offshore wind. So we immediately, you know, had some concerns because we still have so many of these uncertainties with traditional fixed offshore wind. And again, while the ecological, you know, ecosystem impacts of wind are the overarching goal, like there are still basic questions about floating technology and, you know, access to or navigating through these offshore wind arrays. Like, are we going to have in like mid-water column transmission lines that, you know, we don't know any of this stuff, which is making this whole process that much more difficult. You know, because like, again, down in Southern New England area, sure, there might be ecological impacts that we find as, you know, stuff goes in the water and, you know, NOAA, other academic entities are doing these studies. But for the most part, we have been assured that the Coast Guard is not going to prevent access to and through these areas. You know, I know some commercial interests are likely going to just avoid them altogether because of insurance issues. But, you know, that's not, they still, from the government, you know, can transit through and fish around them. But those questions aren't as clear to me with floating technology. And that's been such a struggle. And I don't even think BOEM has an answer yet on that topic. So how that, you know, how that topic is resolved is a huge concern of ours. Just, you know, the Gulf of Maine is so incredibly productive. At the same time, you know, it is warming faster than any other water in the world. So, you do have these strings pulling at each other, which makes this all challenging, because, you want to try to address this with renewable energy. But, you know, you don't want to exclude large areas of the ocean and such a productive region and, you know, harm some of these working waterfronts like we were discussing earlier. So, I've been rambling a little bit, but that's just kind of the challenge of this new technology and of this process. And, you know, BOEM did, you know, again, to your credit, BOEM did a better job in this process with kind of modeling and spatial analysis, but it's still a challenge. You know, no one on either side is going to be happy, you know, and where the final, you know, leases are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of big questions that we as a culture need to embrace and answer and figure out, right? I think that, you know, I tend to get stuck in the idea of food versus energy, right? And where can we produce food and where can't we produce energy, and what does that look like? And, you know, while we need clean sources of energy, we also need sources of high quality, healthy, carbon friendly protein. And, you know, there's a new book that has just come out. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But there was a podcast called Plain English that was the guy was interviewing the author, and she's talking about climate change. She's talking about decisions people need to make, particularly around food, right? And, you know, some of the decisions that we need to make about our own carbon footprint is like, 25% of our carbon in the for individuals comes from our food, the food that we consume, right? And deciding to eat beef or pork instead of something like chicken or fish has a significant impact on that footprint, right? And especially for local seafood, local fish, the carbon footprint is so small that if you were to say, I want to treat myself, I'm going to have steak tonight, but you say, no, I'm going to have fish instead, right? That is the type of thing that can make a significant difference as you start thinking about how we transition people from, you know, a carbon heavy food system into a less impactful carbon food system. And so, you know, that's one of those pieces that I really internally struggle with, because the Gulf of Maine is such a productive ecosystem. It might not be filled with cod in the next 20 years, but it might be filled with pollock or black sea bass or other things that we can eat. And, you know, so I think that that's a piece of it. But the other piece is just that big question of those that have been using this area for centuries, exclusively almost, right? And I recognize it's a public resource, but there's been almost exclusive access for fishing, recreational access into these areas for a long time. And that's changing. There's new industry, there's new infrastructure, there's things that are going to be coming in. And whether it's aquaculture or, you know, offshore wind, some can work better in together than others. And offshore wind, every time that fishermen ask a question about, like, well, what is the technology that's going to be used? Or are they going to be networked together? Or is there going to have to be a substation for energy? Or where is it going to? We don't know that yet. And so for fishermen, you know, they're like, well, you're asking me for input on where you should put these and what it should look like, and can we go coexist, right? I can't answer those questions until you give me some answers. And that's where the conversations thus far have been breaking down, is fishermen feel as though they're being lied to, when in reality, it's just, we don't know yet, right? They aren't being lied to, but they feel as though they are constantly being asked to show their books, right? Where are you fishing? What type of gear are you using? Can you coexist with these things, right? And then when they say, well, where do you want to put these? Or what do you want to do? Or what's the technology? They're like, ooh, we don't know yet. And so they think that the ball is being hidden. And I don't think that's the case, but it certainly feels like that to a lot of the fishermen.
And I will add too, you know, for our listeners, like Ben, your membership, you know, your industry on the commercial side, my God, how many times I wish I had that data in talking about and commenting on these leases, like just the incredibly poor resolution of recreational for hire fishing data and like spatially where these activities are taking place. The fact that we don't have that makes this process so much more difficult on the recreational side. And I don't want to put those both on the same, you know, recreational and commercial on the same playing field. Cause you know, obviously, you know, you guys are out there in a business entity, but you know, and a lot of the recreational side is kind of a hobby, but you know, you're still, it's all culture at the end of the day. And it's all people who have used these portions of the ocean for so long. And it's just a constant challenge on the recreational side of things to comment on these, where these turbines are being, you know, permitted and where they're going to go in the water. Like we don't have that information to be like, oh no, like X 100,000 trips have gone out in the last 10 years, right to that spot. Like it's just not available. And again, just it's just another layer of complexity in this, on this subject.
Yeah, so we're gonna sit, we're gonna wait, we're gonna see what comes out from BOEM. And you know, I think that the final piece that you guys in particular are gonna really struggle with is you know, and we are trying to figure out, but you know, right now the standard for community impact agreements and stuff like that, it's on the businesses that want to build out there to come and figure that out. It's not the government doesn't see that as their role, is to administer that, facilitate that. And, you know, while we have fishermen that are organized through Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, Maine Lobstermen's Association, right? Like we can pull people together. We can talk about impacts. We can, you know, sit down with some of these companies, although that alone is another issue, right? Like then it's like, so Ben, you know, not an expert in energy policy or anything else, right, is now sitting across the table from lawyers, lobbyists, and energy experts. And I have to, you know, talk about stuff with like our communities in mind. It's like, there's some equity issues when it comes to that negotiation, right? But the government sees that as on these energy companies. And I would just say that over and over again, what we have seen throughout history is when you put small businesses, small communities, rural communities in a place to negotiate with some of the biggest companies in the world, the local communities lose every single time. And whether that's recreational access, the small businesses that rely on that recreational access, right? There are a lot of small businesses throughout Maine and New England and the United States that it is big business supplying lures and rods and boats and engines to the recreational community, right? It's really hard. It's really hard. But I do worry that we are going to be in a position to, you know, negotiate with companies that have been doing this for centuries of, you know, whether it's oil, gas, other types of mineral extraction, big energy, like they know how to have these negotiations. They know how to deal with people that look like you and me. And it never works out for the us. And I think that's what's really scary is like, how do we level the playing field? How do we talk about equity in this equation in a real way for ocean users? While understanding that we do need clean energy, right? Like we need to figure out how to solve our climate problem. Otherwise, the storms and the impacts that are destroying our working waterfront, they're only going to get worse, right? And we do need to start tapping that. I don't know that the Gulf of Maine is the place or the time, or now is the time, but I think that you know, we can't go into this saying like climate change isn't a problem, because it is. But is this, I don't know that this is the solution that we collectively need right now.
Especially the kind of current process, how these leases have gone out, where, you know, six leases go for sale and then six leases are in the water and, you know, go according to different permitting processes. But, you know, I think with the Southern New England area, everything probably would have gone a lot smoother on both sides, on the stakeholder communication, on the involvement, on the developers, you know, being successful if they are, you know, maybe we didn't have eight or nine leases all go at the same time. You know, so that's another question. I know this idea of phased leasing in the Gulf of Maine, you know, once we see final lease areas, is, you know, a discussion right now. And, you know, I know that clears up, or not clears up, but that makes it easier to achieve that equity when, you know, the whole community is at least looking at one instead of six different places. So, you know, for our listeners, there are so many different, you know, layers and complexities to this whole process. It is not easy. You know, NOAA is adding so many staff to just, you know, do the work that they have to do to analyze these areas and identify the fisheries that may be impacted. It is straining everyone. No one chose to work on it, or most people probably would prefer not to be deep in the wind permitting discussion. But, you know, it's here, it's happening. And like Ben and I mentioned earlier, you know, that we should start to, you know, see this Gulf of Maine area move forward, and there will be more opportunities to provide input and, you know, share your perspective and what you want, how you want to see the Gulf of Maine region look moving forward. So Ben,
absolutely,
we've been going for 50 minutes now. Any closing thoughts? This was a good discussion. I know for our next discussion, we will have to touch on the importance of local seafood and not buying imported seafood, and, you know, how we can solve the export issue. And I mean, God, that whole side of seafood is so challenging. Like whenever I go to the market, it's like farmed salmon or, you know, like locally caught sea bass, you know?
Absolutely. No, I look forward to continuing the conversation, and I really appreciate you guys and all the work you're doing to coordinate both at the local and national level. And so we look forward to working with you guys on more issues and continue to share the stories of the wreck and commercial fisheries and how we can work together to continue to make things better out there.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Ben. And keep the progress going on rebuilding in Maine and elsewhere in New England, and we will do our part to share resources and get the word out. So
thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.